Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm Tawny Alvarez, your host from Verrill, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Emily Waddell, attorneys at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we're talking about all things accommodation. Understanding your obligations to provide accommodations for medical conditions, for religious beliefs, and in addition, making sure that you're not removing essential functions of an employee's position in the process is so very important. And additionally, we feel that this topic is super timely based off of many employers currently dealing with requests for accommodations from vaccine mandates or otherwise related to the current pandemic. So with that, let's get started. Liz, I always think it's important for our listeners to understand a little bit about why I've asked certain people to come and speak about different topics. For our listeners who don't know you, can you give them a little bit of background about yourself and your practice?
Sure. Thanks, Tawny. As Tawny mentioned, my name's Liz Johnston. I'm an attorney in Verrill's Employment and Labor Law Group. My practice focuses mainly on employment law, both counseling and litigation. Under state and federal law, including disability discrimination, religious discrimination, whistleblowing activity, and the like. So these are definitely issues that we've had come up both in my practice and in our group over the past few months, and excited to dive into them a little bit more today.
Perfect. So that's a little bit about Liz. Emily, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your practice?
Sure. Good morning, Tawny. So I also work in the labor and employment group at Verrill. Similar to Liz, my practice is a mix of transactional work as well as litigation, basically helping employers figure out how to deal with state and federal employment laws, whether that be discrimination, wage and hour claims, et cetera. And personally, my background before becoming a lawyer was as a labor relations human resources associate director for a manufacturing company. So it's been exciting for me to see all of this happening from a practical perspective and now on the other side working as an attorney supporting businesses.
Great. Thank you so much for those introductions. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are saying, Tawny, why did we invite two people to speak on this topic? Well, the thing is religious accommodations and medical accommodations, they are different. We don't follow the exact same path when we're dealing with the issue. Additionally, there's different issues and concerns we're going to face when we're dealing with both of these concerns. So instead of getting one guest to quickly in the middle of the show change their focus and shift to talking about a whole different form of accommodation, I thought it would be more fair for our guests if we split up the discussion. So I'd love to start the discussion talking about disability accommodation. And I'm going to turn it over to Emily to talk a little bit about this topic. First, Emily, I'm sure a lot of listeners are saying, well, is this disability accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act? And if so, who does that statute even apply to? Does it apply to my company? And what do I need to know about its applicability?
Sure. So today we are going to be talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that statute applies to employers who engage in interstate commerce and who have 15 or more employees. But I would caution the people listening today just to be aware that you know, if that's not your organization, you also have to pay attention to what states you're conducting your business in, because there could be state-specific laws or regulations that you have to be aware of when it comes to accommodations related to medical issues.
I think that's a really important thing to know, Emily, because I feel like we talk to a lot of clients who say, well, I don't have 15 employees. So since I don't have 15 employees, the Americans with Disabilities Act doesn't apply to me, without understanding that under state law or potentially even under local laws, it could be one employee and you have similar obligations to not discriminate against an individual as a result of their disability. And that's really the focus of where we start talking about an accommodation, is in order to limit a claim of disability discrimination. Emily, so we know now the employers that the ADA applies to, but who as employees does it apply to? Is it like the Family and Medical Leave Act that you don't get this right or obligation until you've been employed for over a year and you've worked a certain number of hours? Or who specifically is covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Yeah, so employees would be covered by the protections of this law right away. So it's, you know, not like FMLA in that there's a waiting period typically associated with the leave. However, you know, it would be applicable to three specific classes of individuals. So those would be those with a record of disability, those that are regarded as disabled, and those that are associated with someone disabled. So when we think about someone with a record of disability, that's somebody who, you know, has a history of a physical or a mental impairment that substantially limits one or more life activities, or they were, you know, somehow misclassified as having that type of an impairment in the past. Regarded as disabled is going to be someone that the employer or others perceive as being disabled, whether or not they actually are. And finally, associated with someone disabled would be an individual who is associated with or has a relationship with a person that has a disability. So that could be, you know, a family member, a business connection, or some other type of social relationship.
For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Emily Waddell, attorneys at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we're talking about all things accommodation. Now, Emily, you just mentioned three distinct classes almost of people who would be protected under the ADA. What happens if an employee had migraines and they had migraines that were happening monthly, but they haven't had a migraine for, let's say, 6 months? Are they still disabled in that situation?
Yeah, it would be a case-by-case analysis, but generally they would be covered even if the disability or a flare-up, if you will, hadn't occurred for a length of time like 6 months.
What happens if I have the flu? So I'm sick for a week. Is that a disability for that period of time?
The illness itself wouldn't technically be considered a disability. However, you know, if there was, say, you know, implications or ramifications from that illness, let's say after, you know, the flu, you have a breathing issue that manifests into another condition, then that could be covered. So it does become a fact-specific inquiry, depending on what the condition is.
See, that is the perfect lawyer answer. It depends. It depends. So this isn't just like the Family Medical Leave Act, where we know if an individual has been out of work three times, or if they're pregnant, or if they, you know, have an overnight stay in a hospital, that they're automatically disabled. Instead, we're going to look at a multitude of other factors, correct?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's definitely... it is a broader law than the FMLA in the sense that it really requires a fact-specific inquiry into the individual employee and what they're dealing with to see if they're covered, and if they are covered, then what the accommodation would be.
Now, really kind of when we're doing that fact-specific analysis, one of the terms that is used a lot in the law and that I'm sure clients and individuals question is the substantially limits a life activity. When we talk about that term and how it relates to the Americans with Disabilities Act, what are we looking at? Are we looking at, you know, it substantially limits my ability to walk, or can it be broader? Can a disability be broader than just I'm having trouble walking and therefore it's substantially limited?
Yeah, no, that's a really great question. I think, you know, to kind of think through that, the intention of the definition is that a disability is going to be something that impacts a major life activity. So, you know, we could go on all day about what that is, but in the short version is, you know, it could be something like caring for yourself, performing manual tasks, seeing, hearing, eating, sleeping, standing, walking, et cetera. But it can also relate to other functions such as like normal cell growth, functions of your immune system or other systems, organs, et cetera. So, you know, kind of keeping that in mind when you start to pivot and think about what is substantially limiting, it's not really, you know, again, another kind of lawyer answer. It's not exactly a clear cut definition, but what courts will look to is, you know, they are intending to construe this broadly. So it shouldn't be, you know, it's, you know, limits 50%. So that means, you know, XYZ, it's covered or not covered. Instead, really what you have to look to is you have to judge the ability of the individual to perform that major life activity as compared to most people in the general population. So it doesn't require a scientific methodology or a statistical analysis, although that could be relevant depending on what's happening and what the condition is. But you have to kind of do an independent analysis. So someone that wears glasses, say, if they don't have their glasses on, they, you know, probably can't see as well as someone who doesn't need glasses. But you can't use the fact that they're wearing glasses to mean that they aren't suffering from a disability.
From a risk analysis standpoint, I mean, I think you gave a great lawyer answer, but what about for our clients or for our listeners who are saying, well, do I get to determine whether or not something substantially limits, that it truly is a disability? Is that something I should be doing, or should I be calling counsel, or should I just accept once I get a doctor's note saying that they have this condition that it likely is a disability?
So I would assume that it likely is a disability, but I do think that, you know, business owners can, you know, read through whatever medical documentation the employee provides, because that's incredibly important. You know, if it's something that's blatantly, you know, doesn't make sense or it's not adding up, that's an opportunity to call counsel and figure out what the next best step is, because you also don't want to be subject to a discrimination claim if you're asking the wrong questions. And so that's where I think it's really important to engage legal representation. But having said that, you know, it is a very broad definition, but there are things that are excluded. So for example, if an employee was, you know, currently using illegal drugs and they weren't in some type of a rehabilitation program, that could be not covered by the ADA. And again, that becomes a very fact-specific analysis and inquiry that you'd have to go through. But there are other things like that that could be excluded. So, you know, I would say to be discerning, but I'd also, you know, say to clients or to employers, you know, likely it will be considered a disability. So I think you want to be kind of generous in your understanding, but also be discerning.
Perfect. So if we determine that someone's requested or has a disability and they need an accommodation, do they have to come to us and say, I need an accommodation? Or how do we determine whether or not we have an accommodation situation?
Yeah, so that could very likely be the way that the employer finds out about this situation. But having said that, you know, that's not always the case. It could come from a third party. So it could be the employee's family member or a doctor that reaches out to the employer and says, hey, this is going on, you know, can we work for an accommodation? And really what it comes down to is the employer may have an obligation where maybe the employee doesn't come forward, but the employer already knows that this employee has a disability, or they should know that the employee has a disability or is experiencing workplace problems due to that disability. Or say the employee has a disability where the employer should know that that would prevent them from asking for an accommodation. So there is, you know, it's not like the employee has to kind of say the magic words and request an accommodation to be entitled to one. So there is an employer awareness component to this as well.
Perfect. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Let me ask you a question. How do you feel about genetically modified ingredients?
Don't like them.
Artificial flavors and colors?
No thanks.
Clean ingredients.
Now that I like.
When you care about what's in things and what's not, shouldn't your vitamins be clean too? Sundown Vitamins are all clean all the time. Non-GMO, free of gluten and dairy, with colors and flavors from real food. We even have USDA certified Sundown Organics and kids vitamins too. When you're living clean, choose clean with Sundown Vitamins at supermarkets, drugstores, or on Amazon.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Emily Waddell, attorneys at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we're talking about all things accommodation. Prior to the break, Emily was sharing information with us about ADA and providing accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And we ended that last segment talking about the fact that there's no magic words. If an individual has a disability and they might be struggling with certain aspects of their job, that there's no magic words to ask for a accommodation. I want to switch gears a little bit, and I want to turn, Liz, to you and get a sense of what we're dealing with when we talk about religious accommodations. So with Emily, we know that an obligation to provide an accommodation as a result of a disability came under the Americans with Disabilities Act. When we provide a religious accommodation, why? Why are we doing that? Where is that obligation stemming from?
Sure. So one place that we get that obligation is from Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So that's the law that I'm sure many of you have heard about before, but it prohibits discrimination as well as harassment and retaliation against employees on the basis of religion, as well as race, color, national origin, and sex. And so as part of that mandate against discriminating against employees, applicants, comes that accommodation to, or the requirement, I should say, to accommodate religious beliefs. In addition to Title VII, it's also important to look to state law. I know Emily mentioned that in the context of disability discrimination, and the same holds true here. So look to state law to see whether there's also a prohibition on discrimination on the basis of religion, to sort of set forth what your obligations might be there as well.
Now, with the religious discrimination claims under Title VII and your accommodation requirements, does that apply to all employers without regard to how many employees they have, or do we have a similar restriction as we do under the Americans with Disabilities Act?
So we are looking at similar thresholds to the ADA for Title VII as well. So Title VII applies to employers with 15 or more employees, and more specifically, it means 15 or more employees in 20 or more of the calendar work weeks for the current calendar year or the preceding calendar year. So that can definitely have an impact on employers who are seasonal or who have workforces that are sort of fluctuating in size. It's important to pay attention to where you fall as far as that threshold goes.
And under Title VII, is there a length or period of time of employment that's required, like under the FMLA, or is it applicable on the first day of work or maybe even before employment begins?
Yeah, so Title VII's protections against religious discrimination and other types of discrimination are going to apply to applicants as well as current employees. So it'll apply to decisions made really at the outset of the application process, as well as all throughout employment. Really no waiting period as far as those go.
So we're talking about religious discrimination, but I guess I have a bigger question. Religion is a really broad term. When it's used in Title VII, are we talking only about organized religions, or are we talking about spiritual beliefs or eating habits, or, you know, all kinds of different aspects of a person's personhood?
Yes, that's where it gets a little tricky, right? So Title VII has a broad definition of religion, and it extends beyond sort of the more traditional religions like Christianity or Judaism that we might be familiar with. So the way that Title VII defines religion is all aspects of religious observance and practice, as well as belief. Again, not just those practices that are specific to a certain religion or a certain type of faith. So when we're talking about religion, again, it's not necessarily whether it's part of a specific church. It's also, you know, important to think though that it does have to be more specific than just personal preferences or social or political beliefs. They really focus on whether the religion is a sincere and a meaningful belief, which, as the Supreme Court has said, occupies in the life of its possessor a place parallel to that filled by God. That's really the best definition we have of it from the court. That's the guidance that the EEOC has used to sort of put a definition on religion.
I guess since the concept of religion is so broad, it's not surprising that the Supreme Court's definition of religion itself is broad and appears to be, I don't want to say fluid, but something that does evolve. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Emily Waddell, attorneys at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we're talking about all things accommodation. We spent some time earlier talking about accommodations for medical conditions, and now we're digging in and talking about religious accommodations. So Liz, you've set the standard about who Title VII applies to and what a religious belief is. I guess a lot of people are probably thinking though, how does this interact with work? Why would somebody need a religious accommodation for work, especially since most employers try to maintain a boundary between religion and the workplace. I mean, you're going to have some employers that are religious in nature, but most generally, I think employers say, we don't talk about religion. We don't talk about politics. We're here to work. Why would someone need a religious accommodation?
Yeah, so this really comes down to the specifics of what an employee's religious beliefs are. And particularly whether there's a certain aspect of their religious belief or a practice that they need to engage in or they're prohibited from engaging in that might be implicated in the workplace. So, you know, as an example, maybe certain employees might have an objection to working on Saturdays or the Sabbath. So that might be a place where we see a request for accommodation. We could talk more about accommodations in a little bit, but it's really looking at what the employee's specific needs are related to their sincerely held religious beliefs and how those are implicated or not in the workplace.
So when we know our job duties and responsibilities, and when we have either an employee or an applicant, can we presume that they can do all the job duties and responsibilities, or would there ever be a point in time where an employer could presume without having knowledge of a religious belief that that person might be in need of a form of a religious accommodation?
Yeah, so when it comes to discrimination on the basis of religion under Title VII, it's less about presumption and more about motive, right? So whether an employee has requested an accommodation on the basis of religion, or whether an employer is presuming that an employee needs an accommodation based on religion, the motivation of the employer is really going to be key for liability. So one case actually where we've seen that particular issue come up is the EEOC v. Abercrombie & Fitch decision from a few years ago. And in that case, it involved an employee wearing a headscarf to a job interview, and she ended up not being hired. And so Abercrombie argued that she couldn't show that she was disparately treated without first showing that Abercrombie had actual knowledge that she would need an accommodation. But the court found that that's not the standard. It's about Abercrombie's presumption as to whether or not she needed an accommodation.
Let's talk about that Abercrombie case a little bit more, because I think it provides a good example, especially when we're thinking like, well, what kind of accommodations potentially would be necessary when we're talking about religion and religious discrimination or religious accommodation? So what potential accommodation could the individual have been entitled to in that Abercrombie case?
Yeah, so in that particular case, the accommodation would have actually been a deviation from the dress policy for Abercrombie, which prohibited wearing caps. So that is where the interviewer's presumption that an applicant wearing a headscarf would need an accommodation for that, for needing to wear certain garments related to her religious beliefs, presuming that she would need an accommodation from Abercrombie's policy as to the dress code was the key issue there.
Okay, so dress code deviation from policy. That one makes sense. Other than a dress code deviation, are there other policies where there might be the need for an accommodation if we're dealing with religious beliefs or practices?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, earlier I mentioned perhaps an employee needs a certain day of the week off to attend religious practices. So that could certainly be a place where an employee needs an accommodation, like in scheduling. Perhaps an employee needs time off from work during the day to attend a religious service or engage in prayer. That could potentially be a place for accommodation. Other situations we might see is accommodations to company policy about keeping religious material at their desk or posting certain religious symbols in their workplace. Those are all really areas that we could see accommodation requests come in. And again, it's because it is such a fluid definition of what religion is, employers really need to have an open mind and be ready for requests that they might not necessarily be familiar with themselves.
So let's say that we get a request for a religious accommodation. Do we have to provide it? I mean, once there is a religion that's been identified and we receive this request, does the employer have to provide the accommodation that's being requested?
Well, in all cases, it's a case-by-case assessment, right? So it's the analysis is looking at undue hardship. So that's similar to the standard that we see in disability accommodation cases, although it is a little bit less rigorous perhaps when it comes to religious accommodations. But really we're looking at whether an accommodation would impose more than what's referred to as a de minimis cost on the employer's operations. So when we're figuring out whether something would constitute an undue hardship, you know, we look at whether it poses a health or safety risk, whether it violates a seniority structure in the workplace. You look at the type of workplace you have, the type of duties the employee is engaged in, really figuring out whether the accommodation is reasonable under the circumstances and considering the cost to the employer.
Yeah, and this is going to be the same standard that's used under the Americans with Disabilities Act, correct?
It's very similar. It's very similar, correct.
So what I always find to be one of the most difficult discussion points when we're talking about religious accommodations is, what's the line between two individual employees? I mean, hypothetically, if an employee comes to you and says, I can't sit next to my coworker because my coworker is gay, and that violates my religious beliefs, and it makes it difficult for me to focus or work, and I'd like you to move him. Can someone's religious beliefs trump another person's protected classifications?
You know, these are where we get into these really tricky situations. And the general answer is no, you shouldn't disadvantage somebody else or put them in a disadvantageous situation, because, you know, whether or not they're part of a protected class based on somebody's religious beliefs. But at the same time, you know, it is important to look at the accommodation being requested to see if it really is necessary to protect the religious beliefs that are being asserted. An accommodation isn't reasonable if it isn't, you know, specifically addressing the conflict with an employer's policies. And so it's important to keep that balance of protecting everybody's rights involved.
I think that's a really important point, is that I think most attorneys would agree that they'll argue or litigate any day of the week an argument that an accommodation is an undue burden if it's going to violate the rights of other employees. So we don't have an obligation to accommodate one employee's needs by violating the rights of another employee. And that's one of the places where I feel like we get a lot of questions. And honestly, from a personnel standpoint, we run into the most issues.
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, like many cases and situations in this field, it's looking at the situation and analyzing the risk of taking one course over the other and making sure that, you know, you're acting A, in accordance with the law and your policies, and assessing sort of what the outcome is in both situations.
Great. Thanks, Liz. With that, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Man, do I love card night. You ready, boys? You got a king?
Go, fish! that.
Oh, come on. This is WWE superstar Titus O'Neil. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Fall is here, so now's your chance to start up something new and delicious. Let HelloFresh spice up mealtime at home with fresh ingredients and mouthwatering recipes delivered to your door contact-free. Choose from more than 22 chef-curated recipes every week, including low-calorie, vegetarian, and family-friendly options. Say goodbye to never-ending meal planning and prepping with HelloFresh. You can get meals on the table in as little as 20 minutes. HelloFresh features recyclable packaging and pre-portioned ingredients that cut down on food waste by at least 25%. And you're not just cutting your carbon footprint, you're saving 40% compared with shopping in your local grocery store. Plus, more servings mean more savings. So now you can order larger HelloFresh boxes for even better value at HelloFresh.com.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employee relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnson and Emily Waddell, attorneys at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we're talking about all things accommodation. We spent the first part of the show talking about accommodations for disabilities under the ADA, and then we jumped into discussing religious accommodations and what that looks like under Title VII. We focused a lot on kind of making sure that we're not violating the rights of other individuals and that any accommodation we provide does not create an undue burden on the employer. With that, I think it makes sense for us to shift. And I would love to talk about accommodation theories when we're living in a pandemic world. And I wish I could say in a post-pandemic world, but we're still in it. So let's talk about specifically accommodations during the pandemic. And Emily, this first question's for you. Since the pandemic hit, one of the things that we hear from a lot of employers is whether an employer has to move a position to a work from home position, even though it used to be something that required in-office work, specifically because during the pandemic, most positions, if there wasn't an operational need, if you weren't in manufacturing, but a lot of them moved to be virtual from an administrative standpoint. So if an employee who is working virtually during the pandemic now requests to work remotely, are they automatically going to be entitled to work remotely?
So they wouldn't be automatically entitled to work remotely. You know, I do think that we have to acknowledge that, you know, how we work has changed over time. You know, but the reality of it is a lot of employers now are back to work, you know, either full-time in the office or part-time in the office or a hybrid schedule or whatever works for their business, right? So, you know, an employee could come forward with an accommodation requesting to work from home for a medical issue, say, but that doesn't mean that the accommodation is full-time remote at-home work. You know, I do think that employers will have to acknowledge, you know, that a lot of jobs were able to be done from home, and maybe there are some functions that have changed over time. I mean, maybe some tasks used to be done in the office, but through innovation over the last couple of years, they've been able to do that remotely. And that might be something that could be accommodated. But the flip side of that is working from home, you know, might not be the only accommodation available for certain conditions. So, you know, I would ask an employer to consider, you know, could the employee do the job in the office with the appropriate safety measures, whether it's wearing a mask, whether it's, you know, working behind plexiglass or what have you. There might be other options for the employer to consider rather than, you know, pushing the work completely remotely, depending on the condition.
You make a really important point there, Emily, that an employer isn't required to accept the accommodation that's been requested by the employee. Instead, they're going to look at the limitations that are created as a result of the disability that's been identified. And then based off of that, they're going to try to work with the employee to accomplish the essential functions of the job. And I think one of the things that is being missed a lot and that we're not talking about is, yeah, during the pandemic, everyone was working from home. But as we shift and a lot of people move back into a work environment, if 90% of your team is in the office, it may no longer be a reasonable accommodation for one person to not be in that team setting if there is a lot of engagement in person or client meetings or those type of things where you've found that engagement maybe isn't what you were looking for or expect when people are participating virtually, if that makes sense, correct?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, and unfortunately, it's an evolving situation. And, you know, employers are going to have to look at the needs of their business and use that to inform what they're able to do in an accommodation setting.
Great. Liz, you know, my next question's for you. And when we're looking at COVID, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, well, how are we going to relate this to religion, Tani? This isn't about health. We're talking about a pandemic. But what we've been seeing a lot of is religious accommodations that relate directly to COVID-19 vaccine mandates that an employer may have just generally, that they may have pursuant to an executive order, a state mandate. One of the arguments that I think all attorneys and a lot of employers have been hearing a lot of is an individual refusing to be vaccinated because of a belief concerning the sanctity of life. And because of the use of stem cells in the creation of the vaccine, their religion thus doesn't permit them to be vaccinated. Now, a lot of people then respond to that argument and say, well, not all the vaccines use stem cells in their creation. So can't we require employees to simply get the vaccine that didn't use stem cells? Can an employer require that?
I think this is an area where employers need to be really careful. You know, religious beliefs are very complex and the basis for them can be very complex as well. And as to this specific argument, you know, we do see this a lot. I feel like a requirement to have an employee get a certain type of vaccine is really putting the employer into the position of not necessarily scientists, but having to analyze a lot of data and information that often is in conflict with other data and information available potentially to the employee. So requiring one vaccine over another, it really is a risky position, I think, for an employee with a religious belief on that basis, as well as, you know, getting into different arguments about efficacy of one vaccine versus another. Again, it's just territory where it's risky for an employer to be stepping into.
If the leader, if you are part of an organized religion that one of the tenets of the belief system does concern the sanctity of life, but the leader of that religion has indicated that they still believe that individuals should be vaccinated. Can you use that information to determine that the individual's sincerely held religious belief is not in fact sincere, but because the leader of that recognized religion is saying you should be vaccinated, that individual should be vaccinated as well?
You know, the short answer, that's no. So the interesting thing here is with religion in this context is that an employee doesn't have to take 100% or nothing from a religion. So there are definitely cases, and there could be cases where religious leaders of a certain organized religion might make certain suggestions or set forth opinions or beliefs, but the employee might have different individual tenets on those issues. You know, similarly, there can be situations where an employee takes on additional beliefs or practices or observances beyond what is required by a traditional religion. So it's not all or nothing. It's very much specific to the employee.
Thanks, Liz. I think that's really helpful in understanding that just because organized religion's leader says one thing doesn't mean that an employee has to accept that as part of their faith. We're at that time, so we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guests are Elizabeth Johnston and Emily Waddell, attorneys at Verrill in the Labor and Employment Practice Group. And today we've been talking about accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act and Title VII. We spent a good portion of the show talking about who's entitled to accommodations, what employers are covered by Title VII and the ADA, and then generally how to go about responding to accommodations requests. Right before the break, we talked about how accommodations play a role during the pandemic and some of the big issues concerning accommodations that we've seen. Liz, you know, my last question's for you, and I laugh because I say it's my last question, but watch, I'll probably have a follow-up after you answer it. It goes to that. You've been using this term, sincerely held religious belief. You talk about the sincerity. Can an employer make an employee prove the sincerity? And if so, how would one go about having someone prove the sincerity of a religious belief?
That is a great question, Tawny. So you're correct that employers do have an ability and a right to make an inquiry as to whether an employee's religious belief is sincerely held. Again, because that's the standard for accommodation under Title VII. So this can be a tough one. You know, oftentimes we're met with situations where an employee approaches an employer about a religious belief and a need for accommodation. And, you know, that's taken at face value, or it's, you know, the accommodation is granted. But in cases where we have vaccine mandates and these issues that we're dealing with right now, the pressure to assess whether a religious belief is sincerely held has been a little different than in other situations. So the employer is entitled to make that inquiry, but there are certain limits to that. The EEOC hasn't been quite as clear as would be as it would be in an ideal world, as to what exactly an employer is able to do or to what lengths they're able to go. But I think the key first step is if you get a request for a religious accommodation and there's any question about the sincerity, ask the employee for more information. This is a great first place to start. Oftentimes we're recommending that we do that in writing, ask employees to provide more information about what their religious belief is and exactly in their words, how that would pose a conflict with an employer policy.
What about if they respond and say, religion's personal, I'm not sharing any of that information with you, you have to believe me. You know, I said I was only going to have one question, or the last question would be my last, but here's another one. What if they say, it's private, I'm not telling you?
Yeah, I would say in that case, then they're not meeting their end of the bargain for getting the reasonable accommodation. They need to provide an employer with enough information to determine why the accommodation is necessary and how the accommodation will alleviate the conflict with the specific religious belief.
Yeah, that reasonable, I mean, it goes to the fact that, like, it's still an interactive dialogue, and we don't need to simply accept the request that's being made. As Emily talked about, from a disability standpoint, even though someone's requesting one accommodation, doesn't mean that we just have to wholeheartedly accept it, but instead that we're going through this interactive exchange or interactive dialogue concerning kind of why an accommodation is necessary. You know, thank you both so, so very much. I feel like this is a really kind of intense topic that has a lot of different elements to it. It means a lot to a lot of different people. And I thank you both for taking the time to offer your insight as to all issues regarding accommodations.
Thanks so much for having us, Tani.
Thank you.
And with that, you've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for the HR Tip of the Week.
And now, your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Hi, this is Tawny from Verrill. I can't repeat it enough. Wage and hour audits are important. Making sure that employees' job duties and responsibilities are such that we are instituting an appropriate exemption is so important. The learned professional exemption is one that we often hear used in banking, finance, accounting, science, and healthcare fields. In order to be exempt under this standard, the employee must make at least $684 per week. Their primary duty must be the performance of work that requires advanced knowledge, which is predominantly intellectual in character, and which includes consistent exercise of discretion and judgment. The advanced knowledge that the individual has must be in a field of science or learning, and that advanced knowledge must customarily be acquired through a prolonged course of specialized intellectual instruction. For more information concerning the requirements for use of the Learned Professional Exemption under the Fair Labor Standards Act, contact a member of Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.